All right, so this is the Center for the Study of Religion and the City's Coronavirus Relief and Restoration Work. This is Abel Gomez and Ariel Mejia interviewing Siobhan Terrell of the Black Church Food Security Network. And today's date is August 20th, 2020. And this interview should last about an hour. If you had a question, I want to give you space to ask a question. So to start, I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about the organization and the work that y'all do.
Hi, so I am Siobhan Terrell. I currently serve as the Deputy Director with the Black Church Food Security Network. The mission of the Black Church Food Security Network is to create community-based food systems anchored by Black churches in partnership with Black farmers. We aim to create community-based food systems that are led by those who are directly impacted and affected by food inequity. And we have two major programs, Operation Higher Ground and the Soil to Sanctuary Market. And the Soil to Sanctuary Market is where we transform church spaces, parking lots, such as multi-purpose rooms, such as any underutilized space, into a farmer's market where we bring in farmers, Black farmers, to come in and sell their produce to the community. And our second program is Operation Higher Ground. And that is when we transform or we start community gardens on church-owned land. So we transform plots of land into a beautiful community garden where the produce is sold or donated to the community, or given away in the church's food pantry.
Awesome. And I kind of want to follow up with one of the things that you mentioned early on, because I think this is really important. So you said something to the effect, or what I heard you say was that these are initiatives led directly by those that are impacted. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about why that's important.
So the reason why we are doing what we are doing, right? Because a lot of communities, especially Black communities, are deeply impacted by food insecurity and food apartheid. And we are seeking to create a sustainable solution where those who are closest to the problem will be those who are the ones who will lead the solution of addressing that problem. So food apartheid is the systemic self-destruction of Black self-determination to control their food system. And that looks like so many different things, right? That looks like predatory marketing. When you go in some neighborhoods, Black neighborhoods, you see marketing around a 69-cent knee-high. to compel people to spend their money on purchasing this knee-high. Also, you see predatory marketing like the commercials that come on your TV. If you live in certain areas, you probably might see more McDonald's, Burger King commercials more frequently than you will see a Chipotle commercial. Not necessarily saying that Chipotle is healthy, but I'm saying that there are targeted marketing strategies that give people in low-income and Black communities to buy unhealthy food or food that is not nutritious. Another example of food apartheid is Black land robbery or Black land loss. Mm-hmm. So in the 1920s, Black farmers owned 16 million acres. Today, it's less than 2% of that. So less than 2% probably is what, like 2 million acres, or 1,500,000 acres, something around that range, right? And that disconnected Black folks from trying to grow their own food. So that put us in a position to be dependent on organizations, to be dependent on corporations, to be dependent on restaurants, whatever, where we would get our fresh food from. And Black land loss is, or there are so many things that can be attributed to Black land loss, such as USDA predatory lending habits, bank lending habits, different things like that is the reason why Black farmers' land was taken from them. So that put us in a position where we had to be dependent on outside influences to come in and feed us. And we were founded, the Black Church Food Security Network was founded in 2015 in the midst of the uprising, the Baltimore uprising. So in the midst of the Baltimore uprising, a lot of those fast food restaurants, those corner stores, those food retail outlets were shut down in the middle of the uprising. So therefore there were Black communities in 2015 in the middle of this uprising that did not have access to food because they shut down, those food retail outlets shut down completely. And we realized that we didn't want to be in that position. Because if those retail outlets were to shut down, move, close down, then what would the community have to get food from? And that's the reason why we are centered in community and we are centered in addressing our own needs, because it will be sustainable. It will be rooted in the culture and the DNA of that specific area. And I can just go on and on. But all in all, the Black church, we see the Black church as an anchor in the Black community, as a community anchor, an anchor that has the resources to really address the needs of that community, as well as resources to be leveraged for community empowerment and development. So I hope I answered your question. I kind of went all over the place, but all in all, we are seeking to create agency around our food, as well as control on our food, because market demands, decisions will put us in a place of dependence. And as long as we in a place of dependence, someone else will always control what's on our plate. So if we want to change our health of the community health of an area, then we will have to put ourselves in the defining moment to define, or in the position to define what's on our plate.
Wow, there's so much there to think about. And I think for Airely and I, we also did some interviews with Native-led organizations. And already I'm seeing so many different parallels with things that both communities are struggling with. And in particular, I'm really intrigued by the ways in which you described how Black communities have been made dependent and been made vulnerable through specific kinds of government actions and particular kinds of policies. And so you talked about things like a food apartheid. You talked about the ways in which advertising addresses certain kinds of communities to purchase unhealthy foods. And then you also talked about the ways in which land was stripped. And so then all of these things create a system in which certain kinds of people have to reach out to outside sources rather than becoming self-sufficient. Would you say that's an accurate?
Yes.
Awesome. Ariel, I want to send it over to you if you had any questions.
Oh, I just had like a few comments. Okay, so like when you said like the advertising of like healthy food versus like fast food in like certain like communities, like that made me think of like a documentary I watched in my anthropology class about like in Ohio they would have like not a lot of non-healthy places in like Black communities, like no like grocery stores to like buy healthy products, but like in the white communities they would have like all these healthy places and Whole Foods and stuff. So that was something that I kind of noticed. And then also with the food apartheid, I don't know, I just like that term because I've never heard like food apartheid, so I thought that was like really interesting, like that was said. And then Also, I was wondering if you could, like, say the two major programs again.
Yes. So our two major programs at this time are, well, one is Operation Higher Ground, and that's where we start community gardens on church-owned land. Because as y'all probably know, in the cities where you are located, you know that there are churches everywhere. No matter what type of neighborhood you go into, there is going to be a church within that neighborhood. So like I mentioned before, with churches being anchors in that community and having the resources and the assets to really anchor their community as it relates to food security, we also see like resources and assets within that church. And one asset within that church is land. A lot of churches have land surrounding their church that is underutilized. They only mow it. So we see a greater purpose and a larger purpose to the utilization of that land. And one of those purposes is to feed your community. So you can turn that land into a community garden to grow local produce and fresh and organic produce to distribute to your community. And that's a way of community engagement, bringing the community in, so therefore they can learn agriculture and learn new trades. And our second program is the Soil to Sanctuary Market. And another asset within the church that is underutilized is the dining hall, the multi-purpose room. Usually churches have Bible study there, meetings, different things along those lines. So we see another use of this space to be a farmer's market, because a lot of farmer's markets are farmer's markets. So there are a lot of farmers at one market selling their produce. So we create niche markets for farmers to come in and sell their produce directly to the community. Because a lot of Black farmers, they aren't the ones that are getting these big contracts from these large retail grocery stores. They're not the ones. Most of the farmers that we work with, they sell their produce at farmers markets, or they sell their produce at a farm stand. So we wanna make sure that we are creating revenue within our community to support our community anchors, such as farmers, to make sure that we are fed, as well as a lot of the farmers that we work with by default grow organic food. Although they don't have that organic certification, but they grow organic food because they care about how the food is processed, how the food is grown. So we create niche markets for them to come in and sell their produce.
And so what I'm hearing is that there's a way in which not only is are these programs addressing the needs of Black communities to access food, but also creating a way in which farmers can have an outlet to sell their food and also generate income. So it seems like there's a whole kind of loop, right? That then people are not dependent on outside sources that will target them for unhealthy food.
Right, right.
And I'm curious if or to what extent ideas, philosophies, teachings about the Black church impact how the organization thinks about things or organizes?
Yes, definitely. We are students of history. We are students of our ancestors and those who came before us. And we acknowledge that we stand on their shoulders. Like, we are here because of them. Mm. And in the spirit of Ubuntu, I am because of who we are. So we stand on the shoulders of Albert Clegg. We stand on the shoulders of Mother and Father Divine. We stand on the shoulders of Vernon Johns, Fannie Lou Hamer. Because in a way of how we look at history, or we look at history through the lens of them creating a strategy and them creating the outline for the same issues that we are facing today. So we don't seek to reinvent the wheel. The wheel was already created by our ancestors. What we are seeking to do is continue their legacy and continue the work that they strive to do during their lifetime. For example, like Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer started a co-op called Freedom Farm Co-op in Sunflower County, Mississippi. And what she did at this co-op is, it was magnificent. So if y'all ever have time to Google, it was a little community, a little city in Sunflower County. But the main thing that she did was she started a pig bank. And a pig bank was so cool to me, because at her pig bank, she would give away pigs to community members and members of this co-op. And it was in the agreement that when that pig reproduced, you would have to donate those piglets back to the pig bank to continue to strengthen and grow the pig bank so other families can be served through this initiative. So we, in the spirit of that, right, in the mix of COVID-19, we started the seed bank. We said we have seeds. And when COVID first hit in March and April, there was a back order of seeds from different seed companies. So we realized that when the grocery store shelves were empty, we didn't want to be dependent again. Just like anything else, the grocery store shelves was empty. And we was like, well, we still have to eat. So we encouraged our community to start growing their own food. So we started a seed bank to distribute and to mail seeds across the country to people who wanted to start growing their food, their own food on their balcony, in their kitchen, in their backyard, or whatever open space they had available. And towards the end of this season, in November, we will start getting seeds back to continue to use seeds to populate our seed bank. So next growing season in February, before growing season, we can go ahead and mail them out again and then get them right back so we can continue to support gardening efforts across the country. And we also stand on the shoulders of Mother and Father Divine, like I mentioned before. So Mother and Father Divine, they were a part of the Peace Mission Movement in New York. And they were, their ministry was active during the Great Depression. And it's kind of similar now, right? Because we're kind of experiencing like a looming economic crisis. Is it here? Is it here? Is it coming? When is it? But they were in the middle of an economic crisis. And what this church did was they purchased land in upstate New York, and they would use this land to grow food. They would transport the food back from upstate New York into New York City. And then they would have these large feasts, these large gatherings where they would bring in their community to just come in and eat fresh food that's grown local. So we stand on their shoulders because we're seeking to do the same thing by working with farmers to transport food to inner city Black communities to make sure that they are able to have food on their table. And then we also stand on the shoulders of Vernon Johns. Vernon Johns was the predecessor of Martin Luther King at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. And Vernon Johns, what he would do, he would farm on Sunday, get up Sunday morning, preach directly after service. He will go to the front yard of the church to sell his produce to the community. And that's where the idea of the Soda Sanctuary Market came from. So our programs are a continuation of the blueprint that was laid by our ancestors. So we continue to study, we continue to be in communication with our ancestors because the blueprint is already laid to address the problems that we're experiencing today. So we want to make sure that we have a clear vision and a clear strategy and a clear way forward to continue their work.
There's just so much richness in in what you were saying. It's like, I feel like I could just listen to you for hours talking about this. Not just like the ways that these individual figures were innovative, but how they, in a way, provide us with theory, right? They're theorists that provide us a model for how we go forward and how we address these systemic issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's really exciting to see. And so someone with a master's degree, how you said that they're theorists, I like to say that they are very practical. Because a lot of people, or one of the problems that I have with academia is that there are people that's doing research on communities and collect all this data, come up with these findings, offer recommendations, but then that information is not being trickled back to the community. Like there is a divide there. And I would like to say that they are practical in their approach, because what they did was put their pulse on the community. They collected that data called lived experience. They did some, you know, they found out their findings. They like, okay, so let me start a pig bank because that's what my community needs right now. Let me start a co-op because that's what we need, and then go back and implement it, and then go through the phases of ideating, prototyping it to make sure that it works for that specific area. And that's what I was so excited about, is that just being grounded in nature and having your finger to the pulse of the community to actually see and hear and experience the culture, the heartbeat, as well as the gaps in the community, and then finding a solution collectively to address those gaps.
Yeah, a lot of what you're saying, I just agree with, like, I'm like, wow, like, yeah. But I just noticed, like, you were saying a lot, like, you're standing on, like, your ancestors' shoulders, like, on their shoulders. So, like, I was just thinking about, like, the other organizations we interviewed, like, how they would, like, have this, like you said, like, a blueprint that's laid out by, like, your ancestors. Like, they would say the exact same thing. So, like, I've noticed, like, similarities between, like, what you're saying and, like, the Native organizations we interviewed previously. So
that's so good to hear. That's so good to hear. And I honestly think, I deeply feel like that is the way forward. Because one thing that really irks my soul personally is to see each generation start over. I'm like, y'all, we don't have to. I promise we don't. We have just to believe that those who came before us created something, right? It probably isn't tailoring to contemporary times and what we're experiencing now, but I'm sure they had some ideas about the future. And then we just got to find that, and then we can work to, like, you know, buff it off to make it relevant to today. So that's I love that. And then growing up, one of my favorite quotes was, if you don't study your history, you are deemed to repeat it. Or if you don't know your history, you are deemed to repeat it. And that's just so relevant.
I think it's really relevant, like, now, like, especially with, like, the protesting and the whole police brutality. Like, it's just, like, history repeating itself in a way, you know, so I think that's really important. Study your history and stuff. So,
and just to share, like, a really short story with you, Siobhan, there was one of the first people that we interviewed from a tribe called the Amamutsin Tribal Band, which is in, like, the Santa Cruz, San Juan Bautista area. One of the people on the organization board mentioned the story about how in the 1920s, one of her ancestors was interviewed by this linguist, and that this elder had the foresight that at some point the stories are going to be needed to be preserved. And so this guy, you know, this white guy, John Peabody Harrington, recorded, like, thousands and thousands and thousands of notes on her language. And then, you know, more than 70 plus years later, after she's gone, those documents are what these tribal members are using to bring back their songs, their stories, their environmental knowledge, their plant knowledge, and just thinking about like all of these ancestors that thought ahead about what their descendants would need.
Right. I love that story. When I was studying African American studies, one of my pushback for that program, or not necessarily in the program, but in the, the theoretical underpinnings of the program, was that how history is defined. Mm. And we was taught that, or in a certain time period of, I think it was antiquity, history was defined by what was written down. If you didn't have anything written down, therefore you had no history, you had no culture. And I'm like, no, it is relative to that culture. Because like, for example, what the example that you gave me, at first hit or stories were passed down from person to person. And that's how those stories were kept in that generation until someone said like, we need to record this. And I think that's the complexity of different cultures in society is knowing the person who to talk to within that community to get that information. And I think that goes back into the conversation of really studying the culture and really studying the history of that area. Because just because something isn't in a book don't necessarily mean it didn't happen or don't necessarily mean that they didn't think about it. Because someone did, and there's a story to support that within someone's brain.
Yeah, in my African studies classes, we like talk a lot about this, like how a lot of like colonizers would come to Africa and be like, where's your history books? Like, show me your history. And their way of history is oral history. So instead, they would just rewrite their history for them. So it was just like really interesting that you brought up that point, like that, you know, about history. So,
yeah, that's cool. And then everyone likes the food, especially with like culturally appropriate food. Like so many different food charity organizations come in and say, hey, I got this food box, right? In this food box, we have broccoli, we have Swiss chard, we have arugula, we have some other type of greens that y'all don't eat. But here, because y'all are food insecure, I want to give this box to you without having those conversations around like culture. Like what food is culturally appropriate at this time, like for you, and how can we work in partnership to make sure that you have what you need? And that's just like the colonizer mentality as it relates to food access, because people want to come in into communities, low-income Black communities, and save the day. But instead, what we don't need is anyone to save the day. What we need is access to those resources to really change the material conditions of our community. And that's what the mission of the Black Church Food Security Network, that's what we're seeking to do. Because we firmly believe that we have everything that we need in order to change the material conditions of our community. So we can say no colonizers, no food charity folks. Instead, let us work together. Let us put all of our resources and assets in a pot. Let us have these deep conversations to create those sustainable institutions and infrastructure around food security. And that's why much of our work is rooted within the Black church. Because the Black church was founded, I think it was founded in the 18, don't get me wrong. So the Black church was founded towards the end of slavery. The first church was the AME church. And what churches used to do before they were named churches, they were called hush harbors. Churches acted as hush harbors to serve as safe spaces, safe houses for enslaved Africans in their pursuit to freedom. So churches have always been as an anchor and a resource and a place of safety within the Black community to really provide whatever that need was at the time. Like, I graduated from an HBCU. I graduated from two HBCUs, and both of the HBCUs that I graduated from, Tuskegee University and Morgan State University, both have roots within the Black church. Tuskegee University was founded in 1881. Booker T. Washington came down from Hampton, Virginia, and he didn't have anywhere to teach the kids or to teach the students. They just had a plot of land. But what he did was partner with the local church, Bethel AME, to hold his first classes within that church. And while the students who weren't in class were building the bridge, making the bricks to build the buildings on campus. And Morgan State University was actually founded at a church in Westport, Baltimore. So we look at churches as being organized resources, organized assets, and organized people that can support and organize the Black community.
And it seems like, if I'm understanding you correctly, the work that you're doing is also then radically reconceptualizing, rethinking what relief restoration work is, and is not seeking to reproduce a model where outsiders are saying, here, I'm going to give you all these things and have no relationship or any conversation, but instead thinking like, okay, within our communities, what are the resources that we have? And we know most what we need to address. And so let us pull our resources together and re-envision a way in which we can serve our own people.
Yes, yes. And I just love your summaries. They're so beautiful. And you actually got me thinking about this graphic that I always show in my presentation. And the graphic is a graphic that illustrates, it's two illustrations. So it shows three little boys all standing on even playing field trying to reach an apple. And under that illustration is the text called Equality. And then there's another graphic which shows the shortest boy, a boy that's a little bit taller, and then the tallest. And then what they have under them is boxes. So the shorter boy or the shortest boy have the tallest box. So now because of that box, he is able to reach his food. The boy, the middle height, he have a box that's a little bit shorter than the shortest boy. So now he's able to reach the apple. And the tallest boy, he don't have a box because he is able to reach the apple. And under that illustration is the text, Equity. But what food sovereignty seeks to do, the underpinning, the theoretical underpinning of the Black Church Food Security Network is food sovereignty. And what food sovereignty seeks to do is ask questions to those boys like, do y'all even eat apples? Like, who put this apple tree here? Did the community ask for this apple tree? Also, do y'all want grapes? Because is grapes a part of your culture? You know, so this community is actually located in Maryland. So the culture here isn't really conducive to growing apple trees. Okay, so can we grow pawpaw trees? So food sovereignty is creating those food-related initiatives that is rooted within the culture of that community and allowing the community to define its own food initiative and food system.
I like that story.
Yes, I can see. Can I send y'all the graphics so you can add it as a
oh, link? Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Okay.
And you talked a little bit about this a while ago with the, you mentioned starting a seed bank kind of in the wake of the coronavirus. And I'm wondering if there are any other specific ways that the organization has shifted to address some of the specific issues with the virus?
That's a great question. So in addition to us starting a seed bank, we are doing two more things. We are in the middle of the Faithful and Freedom Summer. And we are calling all churches to connect back to agriculture by doing three things. To promote gardening, patronize Black farmers, and practice emergency food storage. We are calling churches to promote gardening because, like I mentioned before, a lot of churches have the land to grow the food, to sell their food, or give their food away to the local communities. And we are calling them to patronize Black farmers so we can keep our Black farms in business, as well as we can support local means to procuring and securing food during this time. And then our last one is to practice emergency food storage. Because as we see in a lot of parts of America, that it looks like the second wave of COVID is gearing up now, sooner rather than later, sooner before we expected, because we expected the fall, but it seems like there are increases now into the rate at which people are being affected by COVID. So emergency food preparedness is we are calling people to start canning, to start preserving their food while we still have the opportunity to grow fresh food. Because in the winter time in Maryland, we won't be able to grow our food if the grocery store shelves get empty again. We won't be able to grow our food if the dollar store shelves are empty again, right? So we got to make sure that we are in the position of looking forward and preparing for the winter time. And while we still have the produce ready now, we are encouraging people to start preserving their food by making, for example, turning cucumbers into pickles, turning tomatoes into tomato soup, turning peaches and other fruits into jams and jellies. So we had a DIY series, a do-it-yourself series, where we taught our community, and it's on YouTube, the Black Church Food Security Network, where we taught our communities how to start seeds inside, how to start a community garden, how to regrow commonly purchased items from the grocery store at home, such as potatoes, onions, celery, different types of herbs, how to regrow all of those items at home. And at the end of the month, we're gonna launch a food preservation class where we will teach people how to preserve food at home with the tools that's in your kitchen right now. So we aren't looking for people to go and buy these extra canning sets and all of these extra things. We are working with what we have because what we have is enough.
So then there's a way in which not only is this organization working to bring people food and make food accessible, support Black farmers, but then there's also this like educational component as well.
Yes. And that's so important because, again, listen to our ancestors and studying our history. That is what we did as a culture. I have memories of my grandma every summer when the peaches became ready on the peach tree, she would go out there and pick those peaches and go in the house and then start canning. And I remember going to her house and just having cans and cans or jars and jars of peach preserves. So we are getting back to what our grandparents used to do, what our great-great-grandparents used to do. COVID is allowing us to do work that's situated, introspective work, right? Where we are focused on what we know, what we was taught, and focus on our what's ingrained in our DNA, right? Because I think culture and society and grind culture and capitalism has pushed us away from our roots. So this moment is really causing us and encouraging us to connect back with what is true to us, what feels good with us, as well as reaching back out to our grandparents again, asking them about their childhood, asking them, like, what did they do back in the day when you had a cold, getting back to those remedies now, and growing it and continuing their legacy through food preservation and gardening. Oh, and then I forgot to mention, the third program that we're doing right now is the BCSA, and that's Black Church Supported Agriculture. So we are starting a CSA where we are securing produce from farmers in North Carolina, Virginia, and Maryland, and we are selling that produce to churches who have food distribution programs now, because a lot of churches have started food pantries and other food distribution programs to make sure that they are feeding their community. So in the spirit of equity and agency and sovereignty, we want to make sure that Black farmers have a market where we are continuing the cycle of self-sufficiency with securing and distributing our food to Black communities.
So right now I'm just thinking about the whole like ancestor thing, like getting back to like going back to like the roots and whatnot that like our ancestors used to do. So
I can definitely recommend a book because I am doing a lot of deep study around this too. And this book is called Working the Roots, if y'all are interested in it. There are so many different remedies in here, stories about how different salves, tinctures, teas were made from different herbs that you can just find outside right now. Yeah, so this is a really good book to read.
Have you tried to make any of those teas?
Yes. Can I show y'all?
Yes, of course.
Let me show you what I did. So we have a garden at the church that I'm a member of, Pleasant Hope Baptist Church. And that is actually the founding church of the Black Church Food Security Network. Reverend Dr. Heber Brown is the pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, and he's the executive director of the Black Church Food Security Network. So at our garden at this church, we grew holy basil. And holy basil is called holy basil because it's good for everything, y'all. This thing is like a super herb. It's good for like headaches. It's an immune booster. Hold on, I got a list because y'all put me on the spot. I'm studying my herbs now, so I don't know everything on the fly. But so it's good for anxiety, mood disorders, stress, sleep issues, poor memory, mental clarity, diabetes. It protects from toxic effects of heavy metals. Like, this thing is so cool. And then I can share this document if you're also interested in herbs.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, but I'm making a tincture. So I actually have to shake it up every day. It's mixed with glycerin. So it's mixed with glycerin, and it's supposed to sit in this jar for 6 weeks. And then after 6 weeks, I would be able to make a tincture, and then it will act as a supplement where I can take it every day. And then, so this weekend, I actually made a elderberry syrup. I made some elderberry syrup. So we have elderberries at our church now, but these elderberries wasn't from the church because the elderberries from the church aren't ready. But elderberry, like, this is a natural cough syrup. And you can take this as a supplement too, and it tastes really good because there's ginger mixed with this and cinnamon and licorice. So this is what I've been trying to get to know more is herbalism and different herbalism recipes, because one of the realizations that I just had is like, wow, the earth produced everything that we need. And that's so beautiful. That is so beautiful to me. So I want to do more exploring and herbalism and then medicinal herbs.
Super fascinating. I earlier this summer did a 7-week online class on curanderismo, which is Mexican-American herbal healing. And one of the things that they taught, like one of my big takeaways, was the practice of doing baños or baths. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, these are all the different ways you can do it, but in particular for people who have dealt with trauma, you can create these baths to give to your loved ones as like, you're not using any chemicals, you're like, it's all natural. And then she was like, the teacher was like, and look at what's growing in your neighborhood. Look what's growing in your backyard. Get to know those plants, and you can make these baths.
Yeah.
With the things that are just growing around you.
Yes. So I'm interested also in foraging, because foraging is it will equip you with the skills to identify plants that's around you. Because a lot of the stuff that we need grow wild. Like I just learned about this plantain plant. So if you ever get into like poison ivy, you would be able to rub the plant, and then the oils that come from it, you would be able to put on your poison ivy. Because it helps with irritations. So that's really cool to me. And yeah, so if you have any notes from that class, I would love to see them.
Oh yeah, totally, totally. Yeah, I mean, I'm even thinking like right now, one of the plants that I'm really interested in is yarrow. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, and from what I understand, one of the things you can do with yarrow that grows very plentiful in the area of San Francisco that I live in, is that if you have some kind of an infection, what you do is you just pick some of the flower, you chew it up, and you put it on that part of your body that has the infection. And what it does, the way that it works, is it like draws out those infections.
That's so cool. Wait, yarrow is like the common name for a marshmallow plant?
No. Okay. This is a different, I'll send you, see if I can. Here we go. Okay, well, it's Wikipedia, which is not always the most reliable, but this is what I'm thinking about.
Oh, I saw this somewhere. I'm gonna order it.
Okay.
I'm gonna try it, because this is so cool to me.
And I think that there are a number of different species, but I think that the white yarrow is the one that is the native yarrow of this territory.
That's so cool. And you can make tea out of it. Well, that's what Google said. I'm gonna have to do more research. Because of course, everything is on Google now. Yeah, that's so cool. Let me save it. But I just dropped a couple of links to making tinctures.
Awesome. Thank you.
Making oils. They're super easy too. I haven't tried to make an oil yet, but it seems pretty easy. And just the different benefits of herbs.
So I'm going to toss it over to you, Ariel, if you have a question.
I just have a comment. I think all this stuff is cool, like all this herbalism. Like I never thought much of it, but now I'm like, wow, like I'm gonna try this stuff out. So it seems really cool. Have you made anything else besides that yet, or?
So the garden manager at Pleasant Hope is actually a herbalist. So we actually made some tinctures. Like he walked me through the process of making tinctures. So I made tinctures with him, with holy basil and lemon balm. And then I also made sea moss gel for the first time. And there are so many benefits of sea moss gel. Hold on, let me Google them. Because I was like, I just bought this because everybody said it is good, good for you. So I was like, let me just try it. But some of the benefits of sea moss gel is that it helps with congestion. And it has like antiviral agents in it. So I made just a regular one. And then it's, y'all, well, you can Google sea moss, but so it's really easy to make because the only thing I had to do was put it in the blender, like a cup and a half of water. And it has no taste at all. So it's tasteless. So one, I made two different jars of it. So for the second jar, I put mango in it. So I'm gonna let people sample it so I can get some raw feedback to see how they like it. But yeah, I really, so this moment is really causing me to be more deliberate about what I consume. Because food is medicine. And food has healing properties in it. Like everything that you eat has some type of healing property, or if it's processed, it probably don't. But yeah, it's really causing me to be more deliberate. Yeah, it's cool.
Man, I feel like I could easily talk with you for hours and hours about all this stuff. That's like so fascinating. And kind of just shifting gears a little bit. Could you talk about the ways that the virus has affected the organization and the members?
So one of our goals for the Faith, Food, and Freedom Summer campaign is to also recruit 100 churches to join our network. So we are a membership organization. And before COVID, we probably had 20 member churches. From different parts of the U.S., from Ohio to Maryland to Virginia to North Carolina. But due to COVID, our organization has grown dramatically. We have churches now in Georgia, Florida, New York, Louisiana, Missouri, Nebraska, and a couple of other places that I'm forgetting about, Indiana, Michigan. So we are growing because a lot of churches now, like this moment has really like cleaned the glasses that people are wearing. Because at first, you know, everybody was wearing these glasses that have been like a little dusty. So COVID-19 is making reality plain for a lot of people and showing people that communities are, people in general are vulnerable as a result of COVID-19. So a lot of people want to put themselves in a position of being of service to their community. So a lot of churches now are really thinking about like, what is the role of the church during this time? How can the church be of service? And then how can we do the mission that God has called us to do? Like, how can we steward the resources that God has blessed us with? So a lot of churches are asking those questions, and it's leading them to think more through the social justice lens of, if there is another crisis, and there will be another crisis with climate change, right? And I always say that there will be another crisis, because climate change disproportionately affects low-income and Black communities. So when there is another crisis, another flood, another tornado, then how can we have the plan to address or be prepared to address those needs as they come? Because other crises will emerge and other crises will happen.
So I want to respect your time. I think that we have gone on an hour, so I'm going to stop it there for today. I'll stop it here.